The travel we discuss in this week's episode of the Carry On Bags Only podcast doesn't involve people. It actually involves the transport of homes that are part of a sustainable initiative entrepreneur Glenn Lewis is leading. Renewal Home Development is on a mission to save homes from landfills, giving them a new life on Vancouver Island and the Sunshine Coast. Vancouver, one of the greenest cities in the world and a tourist hotspot, is experiencing a housing shortage. Glenn shares with us his perspective on the mindset shift that needs to happen, and you will also learn how you can help save good quality homes from being destroyed. So welcome, Glenn, to the Carry On Bags Only podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So Glenn Lewis is an entrepreneur on a mission to prove the possibilities of sustainable community-based development, aiming to build the world's largest walking, cycling, primary community of upcycled homes in the Pacific Northwest. Renewal Home Development was founded in June 2020, which Glenn will tell us more about later in the episode. But before we dive into today's topic, I thought it would be a great opportunity to learn more about Glenn. So do you want to share with us a bit more about yourself and what inspired you to study sustainable community development?
Sure. Well, I guess the starting point for this journey really was I was a student at SFU, Simon Fraser University here in Vancouver, and I went into it studying chemistry, actually. So my major is actually chemistry because I had this really great high school teacher in grade 12. And I kind of like had this like romantic idea of going back and being like a bit of a mentor for teenagers. And plus I liked chemistry. So I thought it was just kind of like a great overall fit. While I was at SFU, two things happened. One, the first thing that happened actually was the Iraq war was just becoming an issue. This was 2002, I think around 2002. I remember like following it. And I remember like the whole lead up to the war. And I just remember really feeling frustrated that there was going to be this invasion of this country. It seemed unjust. It seemed unfair. It seemed like there was going to be a lot of pain and suffering. And that was my first political thing that I ever did was I went to the anti-Iraq war protests here in Vancouver. I think I was in first year at SFU, but I was a chemistry student, right? So like, this wasn't my focus. This wasn't really my area of expertise or anything, but I just kind of knew that there's something wrong about all this. So that was kind of like when my mind started to shift a little bit about to worldly affairs, I'd say. I think it was around the time that Inconvenient Truth came out, Al Gore's documentary. And I remember watching that and being like, wow, this is terrible. And I think the climate change movement really kind of came to me at that point. So I went back and I looked at my chemistry courses. And I was getting kind of close to graduating, but I didn't really love what I was doing. It was fine, but like I just didn't see myself doing it for the rest of my life. I talked to some of my supervisors and they said, well, you know, Glenn, there's this program called environmental chemistry. And basically what you get to do is you can test atmospherics and, you know, water contamination and all this other stuff. And there could be an interesting career for you in that. And I kind of thought that was kind of like, yeah, if I'm going to have to study chemistry, I want to do good and not bad with it. And instead of just coming up with a whole bunch of new polluting chemicals, like I'd rather do assessments and testing and do research and all that kind of stuff. So I did that for a while and I just still realized that it still wasn't enough. Like it wasn't enough of having an impact in this world. And I felt limited in my scope as a chemist / environmental chemist. So I got involved in politics. I ran for student government at SFU. I got elected to the vice president. Then I really kind of realized, you know, what power and change can look like. After I was on the term for 1 year and I learned so much, I was in a grocery store in Burnaby. This was the summer of 2007. And on the cover of one of the magazines in the checkout aisle was Barack Obama. And it was the cover of Time when I read the article. And it was basically at the time, the campaign where Obama was running for the nomination of the Democratic Party to run for president. And I read the whole article and I was just like, this is it. Like, this is what the world needs. We need kind, compassionate, consensus building leadership, you know, that believes in climate change, that believes in the science behind climate change, and that is willing to take some bold action. And that's kind of the feeling that I got from him. Just as I was graduating from SFU, I ended up going down to the United States and I spent a year campaigning for then Senator Barack Obama to become the nominee of the Democratic Party and ultimately to be the president of the United States in 2007, 2008. So I did that for a year. I came back to Canada and I was like, okay, now what am I going to do? You know, like now I've got all this political experience and I've just been part of this incredibly powerful social political movement. And I went back and I studied a program called Sustainable Community Development. It's a great program at the Simon Fraser University. What it really looks at is, you know, here's what's wrong with capitalism. And here's what's wrong with urban development. Here's what's wrong with social development as we understand it. Here's what's wrong about with environmental stewardship as we understand it. It just basically critiqued every form of development. And then it said, okay, what does the alternative look like? The alternative is sustainable, community-based, economic, social, urban development. It turned so many concepts on its head. And I thought it was amazing. I was so happy to be part of the program because it gave me a framework of like, okay, well, it's not just enough to critique the conventional modes of development. Like, what does the alternative look like? And can we truly build a more sustainable world, be it through urban planning or be it through how we rearrange our economies and whatever it might be? So fantastic program. Ended up doing my undergrad thesis in the program with a gentleman by the name of Mark Rosalind, who I'm still in touch with, who was my thesis professor. Then I kind of like forgot about it, to be honest with you. I got involved in the consulting world. I co-founded a company called New Mode. We built software for political campaigns and political movements. Did that for a long time. New Mode's done really phenomenal work all around the world, actually. It's like, I think we've got presence in 4 countries now.
Wow.
I stepped away from it, and I think it was around 2017, 2018. Then I started looking for what was my next step. And my sister was living in this really nice, charming 1920s home in Esquimalt, which is just outside of Victoria. A developer bought the whole block. They were going to tear down all of the homes on this block to build townhomes or apartment buildings or whatever it was. And my sister was like, well, this is a shame. I don't want this home to be torn down. It's beautiful. She loved it. So she talked to the developer and she's like, well, can we just move it? Through some negotiation, the developer's like, yeah, you can just take it because we're like, the developer's going to pay to tear down the home. So my sister went with a very simple value proposition. It's like, what if we just relocate it? And then all you're left with is the foundation and what's below grade kind of thing. So she worked with a company called Nickel Brothers to physically pick up her entire home and move it to property that her and her partner bought just north of Souk, kind of towards Jordan River. When I heard that story, this was about 3 years ago now, I was like, this makes so much sense. I started doing research. I started looking into it. You know, what kind, are we talking about nice homes? Are they like kind of nice homes? Where are they? What does it cost? Just, you know, all of those basic questions. And the more research I did, it's just like, well, this is everything I studied, which is like, you know, how do we build sustainably and how do we not just tear down trees and, you know, extract all of these minerals? It's that terrible model of like input, output, and then waste, you know, and it's not circular at all. And so much of our how we build homes, how we build buildings is so linear and not circular. And it's cheaper. It's like way cheaper to relocate a home. So all that to say, I started Renewal with a business partner. We did our first proof of concept. We moved a house, a rancher from Coquitlam to the Sunshine Coast. We learned a ton because there's a ton to learn in this business because there's not a lot of people who have done it before. We took all of that learning and now we're iterating on it. I ended up buying out my business partner. So I'm now the sole proprietor of this company. And that's kind of where we're at. Like, we're at this point now where we've figured out a really wasteful industry, which is home demolitions. I'm now in the process of building capacity to find all of the homes. And eventually we want to find accessible land to take them to repurpose them.
Yeah. Just to hear your journey into it is incredible. And the fact that you're able to see an opportunity like this, I think I read a stat on the website that said that there's something like 2,800 single family homes that end up in the landfills, which is insane.
Metro Vancouver is one of the demolition capitals of the world on a per capita basis. Like, there's very few cities in the world that tears down as many buildings as we do. The main part of that is we're going through intense densification. Metro Vancouver is the fastest growing region in Canada. I think it's one of the fastest growing in North America. We have massive immigration coming into Canada from all over the world. BC and Metro Vancouver is taking a lot of that immigration. So right off the bat, you've got a growing population. Like, you've got way more people living here. Then the other dynamic is that you've got millennials who, and there's, if you look at the demographic trends, you've got this really big group of late 20s, early 30-year-olds who want to start buying homes now. So those two things are coming together to put massive pressure on our housing market. And what's happened is that we've got way more people wanting to live in homes versus how many new homes we have. That demand and supply pressure has been putting so much pressure on our housing prices just because there's not enough housing, which is why you get into situations where there's 5-10 bidders for a condo or for a single family home or whatever. We are facing all of that pressure for housing. Now, the problem is that we've got the ocean to the west, we've got the mountains to the north. Eventually, you get to the United States on the south. And if you keep driving out past Hope, you're back into mountains on the east. Like, we are, you know, it's a big region, but we're locked in here, right? It's not like Calgary, you can just keep going out or something like that. So ultimately, land is scarce. And so what's happening is a lot of these developers are buying single family homes because they want the land. They tear down the homes. They don't care about what's the value of the home. They don't care how nice the home is. They don't care how recently that house was built. They're just buying that single family home for the land. They tear down the home and then they build their townhouse or their apartment building or whatever they can get away with. And municipalities are encouraging that density. Like, every municipality in Metro Vancouver right now, I'm pretty sure, is upzoning. And we're even seeing it at the provincial level. I think I was just reading David Eby, he's running for the nominee of the New Democratic Party and likely next premier. One of his housing platforms was to rezone large swaths of single family homes for greater density. So the pressure we're in, Kelsey, is that there's all of this demand for density. Problem is, we've got tens of thousands of single family homes. Now, I don't think those homes make sense. Like, I don't think it makes sense to have a single family home across the street from a SkyTrain station. That makes no sense. So from an urban planning perspective, they didn't make sense to begin with, but we went with it because this was the 40s and 50s and we wanted to build communities around cars and suburbs and all that kind of stuff. And now we're trying to like retract all of that and we're trying to build complete communities. But in the process of building complete communities and building density, we're tearing down all of these single family homes, literally hundreds that are beautiful, high value homes. So that's the waste, right? So we come along and we say, listen, there's 2,800 homes that are slated for demolition this year in Metro Vancouver. We estimate about 20% of those are in good to excellent condition. So 20% of those 3,000 homes are worth trying to save. So our mission is to identify them, figure out the economics of moving them, and then find land to take them to, and then repurpose as many as we can.
That's incredible. And it's crazy because I was looking through your website and you're right. There's character homes and there's a ton of really nice new builds. So yeah. It's crazy to think that those are completely just getting destroyed and moved to the landfills.
Well, the crazy part is these homes, and some of them are valued, like the building envelope itself is valued at 500,000, 700,000. I've seen homes valued at 2 million plus. And from a developer's perspective, that asset to a developer, that's an obstacle because they don't want the home. They bought it only for the land because they want to build townhomes and condos and all that kind of stuff. So it's not only environmentally wasteful in terms of the material waste going to the landfill and in terms of the greenhouse gas embodied carbon in that home that's being wasted, but it's also unbelievably economically wasteful because there's so much value in some of these homes.
No, and one of the things I wanted to ask about was just around, you know, some of the obstacles that you're facing when you're trying to move some of these homes. Because I know there's like trees and trolley lines that get in the way. Physically moving them, like to have the house itself moved, is less than maybe doing a new build. But, you know, what are some of the obstacles?
Let me just start off with the numbers right off the bat. So roughly, this is plus or minus, it's about $100 a square foot to move a home, plus or minus. It could be 80 sometimes if you're really close to the ocean. It could be 120 if there's a whole bunch of power lines and all that. So if you went to a contractor on the Sunshine Coast or on Vancouver Island or on one of the islands, Pender or Gabriola or Bowen, they're quoting you $400, $500 a square foot to build. Right off the bat, if you look at how expensive construction is becoming and how hard it is to find good contractors and laborers, home relocation and home repurposing from an economic perspective or from a financial perspective is incredibly advantageous. So yeah, and coming back to something else that you mentioned too, is that, you know, I think a lot of people have this misconception that these homes are old, crummy homes. And I think that's an incredible misconception that will blow people's mind when you realize that actually, sure, some of them are. 60 to 70% of the homes that we look at deserve to be torn down. Just like, okay, there's no value there. They haven't been well maintained. They haven't been well kept up over the years. There's 15, 20% that these homes are renovated. And now it could be, like you're saying, it could be a character home from the 1910, 1920s, 1930s. It could be some rancher that was built in the 1950s, but was completely renovated in the last like 10, 15 years. And there's homes that were literally built 10 years ago or 5 years ago that are now slated for demolition just because they're in the way that some developers' projects. So that's all the great stuff, right? So 60 to 70%, get rid of them, 15, 20%, lots of value there. How do we save those homes? And so I'll tell you this, I think people will hear this and they'll think that there's an opportunity here, and there definitely is an opportunity here, both from an environmental perspective and from an economic perspective. It is unbelievably complicated. And there's a lot of complexities around the relocation routes. So to your point, trees lining streets, overhead walkways. The biggest one actually is overhead power, trolley, and fiber optic lines. So anything that's above you, if you're dealing with anything that's other than a rancher, anything that's got a flat roof, you can generally get them underneath a lot of things. And that's kind of the bread and butter of the relocation repurposing industry, is low one-story homes. But there's tons of beautiful two-story homes. And then the question is it economic to try to save those homes? Because you're going to have to pay BC Hydro and TransLink and TELUS to come along and to help drop or unclip their line so that you can get through an intersection or whatever it is. So yeah, there's a lot of obstacles. And so that really just comes down to, you know, there's two questions. Is it physically movable? And to be honest with you, most houses are actually physically movable. The second question is, it economically viable to be moved because of the costs associated with dropping power lines and, you know, all of the complexities of a move. So those are the two questions we have to put together. And then the third question is like, where does it go? Like, where is the right place for this home to be relocated to? And that's also a super challenging question, because again, you want to be near ocean, because ultimately these things go on a barge. You take the barge up to Gibson or Powell River, and then from the barge site, and you find the right barge site or access point, then how do you get it to the property that you want to take it to? So if anybody ever tells you this is easy, I have a couple of years of experience now of like so many projects that we thought were going to work and then just didn't because of one barrier we just couldn't overcome, kind of thing. So the question really is what can we do from a policy perspective to make it easier, right? Like, you think that, so we tear down 2,800 single family homes in Metro Vancouver alone. There's probably another 1,000 on the island. There's a stat from Metro Vancouver that the average 2,000 square foot home demolished produces about 100,000 kilograms of material waste. So that's like concrete, wood, metals, drywall, and other building materials. That's 100 tons right there of material waste, just physical material waste. The 2,800 single family homes demolished in Metro Vancouver produces about 280,000 tons of material waste every year. It's about 40% of our landfill is full of material waste from demolished buildings. So there's that, you know, from a public policy perspective, if I'm talking to the Metro Vancouver, if I'm talking to the city of Vancouver, if I'm talking to the province, it's like just that alone, you'd think that we'd want to divert as much of this waste as possible so that our landfills aren't full of garbage, essentially. And it's not even garbage. It's like there's some beautiful buildings here. Then the other lens to look at this through is from a climate change perspective. Right. So if you look at this from an energy input and greenhouse gas emission output perspective, single family dwellings, 70 to 80% of the energy input greenhouse gas emission output associated with the entire life cycle of a single family home is in what's called the upfront stage. So that's the, you know, cutting down the trees, getting the plastics, getting the drywall all put together, and then the construction of the home. Yeah, so there's a ton of emissions, or embodied carbon is the concept, in the construction of a new single family home. And every time we tear down a home, sure, there's some more greenhouse gases and energy input and embodied carbon associated with the demolition part of it, but most of it, it's in the upfront. So every time that I can take a home, move it to Gibson or Powell River, and someone gets to live in it for another 30, 40 years or whatever it might be, because it's a beautiful home, we're mitigating that upfront carbon that someone else would have gone and built that person a brand new home. So that to me is also fascinating. Like, if we're talking about climate change objectives and mitigating climate change and net zero building, there's a huge opportunity in saving hundreds of these really great homes, relocating, repurposing them. And so whenever I have a conversation with municipalities, I'm like, listen, there are some things that we need from you to help this industry. if it's, you know, maybe a tree here and there needs to get removed so we can get through a corridor on Cambie Street in Vancouver, or maybe tell us, we need you to work with us a little bit more closely about unclipping these lines and creating a better process and all that kind of stuff. But on the flip side, here's all of the environmental benefit of what we're trying to do. And so that's the conversation we're constantly trying to have, because I'll tell you this, Kelsey, my objective is to enable this industry. My objective is to make this more common, more possible, more economically feasible. And a lot of that has to do with policy conversations and decision maker conversations and seeing what they can do to help enable the industry. But if we do it, I can see massive potential.
Oh yeah, for sure. The one thing that I really appreciate about living in Vancouver is how green the city is. And I know one of the stats that I saw from a UK waste management company is that they labeled Vancouver as being one of the greenest cities in the world, which is really cool. But to know the flip side of that, knowing all the demolitions and the stats, it's kind of counterintuitive. So I think to be able to, you know, pitch this idea, I think is incredible, to be able to encourage more people to think of this, especially from a climate change standpoint. And I know this week, I believe it's on the 15th, Vancouver is going through a city election. And I know a lot of the platforms of everyone is targeted towards sustainability and housing. So, you know, hearing you talk about the policies and things that need to change from, you know, a listener's perspective, like, is there anything that, you know, citizens could do in your mind to help, you know, maybe make some of these things change with some of the policies to allow this to happen more?
Right. Well, I think that's a really good question. I'll give you an example. So here in Vancouver, there's a street called Cambie. And on both sides of Cambie, there's massive redevelopment happening, right? There's tons of really, really nice single family homes. It's kind of a more affluent area. People have like invested in really nice homes or renovated these things well. And there's probably a couple hundred that in the next 5 years are going to be torn down within about a 3 or 4 block radius of Cambie, both sides. How do you get the homes out of these areas? You come down Cambie before Marine Drive, you turn right, and then you turn left, and then you cross Marine Drive, and then you get down to the Fraser River, and there's a barge site down there that we've identified that we can use. To come down Cambie, Cambie's nice and wide. There's one trolley line that we got to cross at 41st. You cross 41st, you turn right. There are 5 trees, and I think they're about medium-sized trees, small to medium-sized trees. And those 5 trees, Kelsey, right now are inhibiting our ability to save and to move homes from the Cambie corridor area. 5 trees. And the arborist, when we applied to, because you have to apply to move homes out of, through a city, it's called like a move out permit. We put forward a move out permit to save some homes from like 29th and Cambie. And we say, this is the route we want to take. And here's the disruption. And here's the traffic management plan and all that kind of stuff. But we had identified 5 trees that were prohibiting us from getting through right before when you get through to Marine Drive. And the city arborist said, well, we can't remove those trees. And we said, you know, we'd replant them and here's, you know, all that kind of stuff. And there was a hard no from the arborist. And what I find really fascinating about that response that we got from the city, at least from the arborist, was it seemingly was so devoid of the other impact. Right. So like, I get it. It's a trade-off and we have to see it as a trade-off, right? On the one hand, you've got 5 small to medium-sized trees that would need to get removed, but we'd replant them eventually. On the other hand, there are hundreds of homes, hundreds of really good single-family homes all along Cambie that we're trying to save, relocate, and repurpose on the Sunshine Coast, on Vancouver Island, wherever. And here's all of the stats about material waste. And here's all the stats about us mitigating greenhouse gas emissions. So where's the holistic perspective about, okay, I get you don't want to, nobody wants to tear down 5 trees. Nobody wants to do it. But we're saying that if we do this, we can unlock and we can relocate and repurpose hundreds of beautiful, large homes from the Cambie corridor. So those are the kind of trade-off conversations that are ultimately political. You know, I've been talking to some of the city councilors who are running here in Vancouver and just trying to tell them like, this is like, it's literally almost insane about that. We don't take this more holistic, bigger picture perspective on these things. And so from a public's perspective, which is your, I think your original question, I think that, you know, there's going to be conversations coming up and there's going to be moments where public participation in some of these conversations is going to be important so that our city councilors, especially our city councilors, know that, listen, we want to try to save and repurpose these homes, and we don't want to just throw them away needlessly.
I'm glad that we are able to talk about it because it's so top of mind right now. One of the other things I wanted to highlight, once you've moved the homes, you actually do a little bit of like retrofitting on them to make them even more sustainable.
Well, yeah. And so, you know, we'll look at insulation is the biggest thing. So one thing I've learned about sustainable development, it's not about buying expensive new tech. It's actually the low tech stuff like insulation that can sometimes have the biggest impact. So insulation is a really easy and important one, you know, changing your windows, and there's energy programs and rebate programs now for, you know, improving the efficiency of your windows, the heat pump conversion. I think that's a provincial one that we'll look for all opportunities we can to make the house as efficient as possible. And then we'll do things like rainwater catchment and garden boxes. We did add solar panels to the last home so that it's generating clean energy for itself. And the solar panels is an interesting one because, you know, there's an argument that we actually create a lot of clean energy in BC. I think it's like 80% of the energy that we use is BC Hydro. But, you know, there's also an economic argument to solar panels, which is, like, I think the ones that we added, the house produces about 50% of its own energy per year. That actually gets sold directly to the grid. It gets sold directly to BC Hydro. So after 10 years, they pay for themselves. It's like it's a net cost input output equivalent. And then after about 10 years, they're generating revenue for the homeowner. So it's actually, it's a moneymaker. It's, I think it's like $1,300 a year. So it's not nothing, but it's considerable enough that, you know, it's an interesting incentive, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And I guess from my perspective, I guess feeding off of your question is like, you know, it's not just enough to repurpose a home. I think that's great. I think it's great from an environmental perspective. I think the character and the architecture, and if we can save that, even better. If we can add insulation, if we can retrofit the windows, if we can add the heat pump, the rainwater catchment, the solar panels, all of that stuff is amazing, right? But I think ultimately, I'm still really interested in the rethinking the car culture model. And do we really need to be building our communities around cars? And do we, you know, one of the things that I've, you know, like my mom's Greek, I've spent a lot of time in Europe. It's like, the idea of a village and the idea that you can walk to your coffee shop and you can walk your kids to school and that you can walk to your doctor's office and you can walk to work or bike to work. I think like ultimately I'd love to build some sort of walking, biking primary community where we don't rely on the car so much. And I know Teslas are like burning way cleaner energy, especially if you're fueling it with BC Hydro clean energy. If you're powering the batteries of your Tesla with BC Hydro power, it's a lot better. But ultimately, the input of buying a new Tesla is still very high. And it's the same with the house, right? So with a house, the life cycle analysis of a house, I said that 70 to 80% of the energy input, greenhouse gas emission output is actually in the production of the house. And it's very similar for cars. A lot of that is in the upfront energy input, greenhouse gas emission output. So it's not actually in the operation of the Tesla. It's in the creation of the Tesla to begin with. So how do we just move away from that and create better socially balanced communities where you can see your neighbor and you can, you know, have social interaction and not just sit in your car by yourself for 10, 20, 30 minutes every day?
I think that's a really cool concept. And I had a car for a while when I first lived in Vancouver, and then I got rid of it. And I remember thinking like, oh, this is the worst. And right. I moved to Toronto for 3 years and didn't have a car. And then ultimately just came back here and everyone's like, when are you going to get a car? And I'm like, I don't know. We'll see. And I've honestly gotten so used to just biking and walking and using transit that I would love to live in a place that didn't, you know, wasn't focused on car travel. And I think that's the beauty of Vancouver in some ways with the densification is that it is a walkable city. Whereas I'm from Calgary originally. And like you said, it's a city where it just keeps expanding out. And that was a city that I really needed to have a car in. So I think it's really neat that you're focused on so many different aspects of this home development.
Yeah. And I have a friend, Ryan Johnson, he's building America's largest car-free community right now. It's just outside of Phoenix. It's called Tempe. And the project's called Cul-de-Sac. It's 700 residential units. There's no cars anywhere. And I went and visited with Ryan. You can't own a car. Like there's literally no parking spots for this whole, and this, it's basically a small little village, right? And there's like an LRT stop right next to the entrance of this little village. So you can take the LRT, get downtown Phoenix, go to the airport, all that kind of stuff. They will have car sharing programs. So if you want to go to Los Angeles, if you want to go hiking for the weekend, whatever, I think it's fascinating that they, first of all, that from a city zoning perspective, that they were able to build a, like a village with no parking spots. And that second, that you can't even, they won't, they're not even accommodating you if you own a car, which I thought was fascinating. But I just love that. And Ryan tells me this stat that I thought was really interesting, which is, I think something like 80% of home buyers want to live in a walkable community, but only 10% do.
Wow.
And by walkable, it's, I think it's like, I don't know if it's 10 minutes or 15 minutes of like, you can get to X amount of services and whatever, but it's because of like, how, like, if you look at most development projects, how are they built? Highway, roads, front yard, house, backyard, lots of sprawl, lots of space. Well, you know, like good luck walking your kid to school and going, walk into the coffee shop in that model, right?
Yeah.
So, and that's the irony, like a bit of the irony of this whole thing is that like, I, again, to build a village like Ryan's cul-de-sac, you need density. You need to bring people closer together. And the single family home doesn't make sense in an urban setting. Where I think it still makes sense for now is in exurbs, Powell River, Comox Courtney, Souk on the island. There's some communities where the single people want some space. They want to live closer to nature. They don't want to be living on top of each other. They want to live a bit more peaceful living. And I think the single family home will still make sense for those people for now.
I wanted to ask too, because I think one of your, like where one of your first houses went was Gibson's, if I'm correct.
And yep.
I don't know if this is, if I read this, but is there bylaws now like that are like hindering you being able to move houses over? Or is, has that been, are you still successful to be able to bring stuff over onto some of those more remote areas?
So it depends. So some jurisdictions are easier to work with than others. I'll tell you, there's the entire area around Powell River, so which is on the Sunshine Coast, which is about an hour away from Vancouver. Well, it's about like a half an hour seaplane ride, but if you want to take the ferries and stuff, to 2-3 hours kind of thing to get up there. But as the crow flies, it's actually not that far. There's a regional district called Cawthet, Q-A-T-H-E-T. Cawthet has no building permits and it has no development permits. Like it's called unpermitted. So basically all you do is you move your house over there, you drop it down, you have to meet certain health, like coastal health requirements, but otherwise nobody's really, there's no sign off. It's wild. It's literally the Wild West. So there's communities like that that will always make sense for us to try to move to. People move homes to islands very often because of how complicated and expensive it is to build on an island, on a remote island, where you can't get the materials there easily and you can't get the contractors there easily and stuff like that. And the cost of construction is really high. Like I said, on Bowen, for example, it's like $500 a square foot. But the challenge with islands, just with a lot of these places, is like you've got to find accessible land. And that's part of the big work that I'm working on right now with some researchers and some GIS mapping students, is to identify land that we can more easily get homes to.
Is there a spot that you're putting a lot more homes? Like, is it in like Victoria? Is it, you know, on the Sunshine Coast?
Well, my focus for, I think going forward, is going to be Powell River and around Powell River. It's a lot of low bank access. It's ocean. It's a coastal community. It's a growing community. And it's cheaper. I just think that there's a lot of opportunity for my business model up there.
And were you nervous at all to start this up during, because you started it during like COVID in 2020?
Right. Well, it was, I mean, the market was perfect. Like when we first started buying properties, like it was like we got in at a very good time and then things kind of got great. Like the market really took off. It was, you know, it actually was kind of perfect for house relocation, because what was happening with COVID is that people were leaving the city, right? They were like, I don't need to be in this, like people who could all of a sudden work a bit more remotely were like, I don't need to be in the city. It's more expensive. Why don't I go live in Gibson's or Seashells or Powell River? And so there was a ton of migration, especially amongst younger families. So the market really was favorable for us. I'm of the belief that there's going to be still lots of great demand up in those communities. I think that Metro Vancouver is, once we come up, once interest rates stop going up, and once interest rates start coming back down, there's going to be a flood back of demand into the housing market. There's a lot of renters right now, but rental prices are going up. So there's a ton of pent out demand for housing. This immigration, these waves of immigration aren't stopping. Cost of construction is going up. There's just so many different pressures that I think that this is always going to make sense. And Kelsey, I'll tell you the last one that I think is really interesting is that whenever I'm up in Powell River, I like just talking to people, understanding like, you know, where did you move from and why did you move up here and all that kind of stuff. a lot of people think that people left the city because of a cost of living. And it is like, it's, you know, you can buy in Powell, you can buy a property, a quarter acre property for $200,000 in Powell River. You couldn't buy a quarter acre bare lot property in Burnaby for less than, like, I don't know, $1 million or whatever it is. It's like, it's just unbelievably cheaper up there, right? But it's not only people leaving because of cost of living. I talked to a couple of families in Powell River last time I was up there. And I was like, you know, like, you know, how do you like it up here? How long have you been up here? Why did you move up here? And they're like, Glenn, you know, we had houses in Kitsilano. The kids were young, but it was just getting so busy. Vancouver's was this kind of like this small city, right? And I'm watching it, and you can see all the cranes, and you see what's going on with the subway and the Canada Line, and you see all of this growth and construction and way more people, and we're densifying. And every time you walk somewhere, there's way more people on the sidewalk. And that isn't for everybody. You know, not everybody signed up to live in Manhattan. Not everybody signed up to live in downtown Toronto. Some of these people, a lot of people who grew up here, they wanted that quiet street and they wanted that kind of smaller feeling. And so there's a lot of people being pushed out of Metro Vancouver right now, especially people that I know who want a quieter, calmer lifestyle. And so I think there's always going to be, I think there's the next 5-10 years still looks good for places like the Sunshine Coast, Vancouver Island, Powell River.
Well, thank you so much. I don't know if there's anything else that you want to share with anyone, because I know we're running close on time, but one thing that I was just going to mention to people is to definitely check out your website, which is
renewaldevelopment.ca.
Definitely check out the section that shows some of the homes that are up for demolition to get an idea of what some of those homes look like as well. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for chatting, Kelsey.
Thank you so much for listening to the Carry On Bags Only podcast. If you haven't already, hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode. Until next time, keep calm and carry on.